Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello, I'm Justin Brierley. Welcome to another classic replay, a midweek show from Unbelievable, bringing you some of the best shows from the last 10 years, really. This one from 2013 was with Rowan Williams, who led the Anglican Church for 10 years as Archbishop of Canterbury. And in this conversation, he reflected on his journey of faith and the trials and joys of his time in office. It was a wide-ranging interview. And we discussed why he briefly considered becoming a Catholic, what he made of new atheists like Richard Dawkins, the debate on penal substitution, and even whether he's had doubts about God himself. Hope you enjoy this this in-depth interview with Rowan Williams from a little while ago, but still very relevant, I think. Not too late also to join our live show with Tim Keller. That's happening tonight on Tuesday the 13th of December, the day this podcast goes live. We'll be talking with Tim Keller about his well-known New York ministry to skeptics, his own journey with cancer over the past 2 years. Plus, any questions you have for him as well, just register to be part of it. It's not too late if you're listening today, Tuesday the 13th of December, to join us. Unbelievable.live is the place to register and be part of that. The link is with today's show. For now, hope you enjoy today's edition of our Classic Replay. Tonight, we meet the man who for 10 years led the Anglican Church through a decade of upheavals and controversy.
I'd always seen it as the role of an archbishop, just to try to keep people at the table. And the difficulty is that a lot of people think the role of an archbishop is to solve it, you know, pronouncements.
Do you feel like you did keep people at the table?
Limited success, I'd say. Limited success.
We'll hear his personal account of weathering some of those storms, like homosexuality and losing the vote on women bishops.
I felt, of course, a deep sense of sadness, feeling that we were in danger of almost losing a generation of very able women clergy, and just feeling that somehow all of us were certainly hung out to dry in the eyes of the world.
We'll be learning about his faith behind closed doors. In your time as Archbishop of Canterbury, have you ever had doubts about God?
Doubts about whether I'm making any sense of God. Yes, very regularly.
We'll discover his thoughts on the next person to take on his mantle.
I'm really so excited by his appointment. Genuinely, he's a focused, clear, and very impressive thinker.
And we'll hear where he sees the UK church, both now and for the future.
Christianity, I think, has nothing to fear. We have the promises of God. Basic as that.
I'm Justin Brierley, and tonight I'm in conversation with the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. Well, Rowan, it's lovely to have you join us here at Premier Radio. Thank you very much for coming in. You look a sort of like a man who's relaxed now.
I can't imagine why.
We'll come to all of that. Let's start right at the beginning, though. Tell me a little bit about your life growing up. You grew up within a Christian context, did you?
Yes, a Welsh nonconformist family. We used to go to a Presbyterian chapel in Cardiff when I was a small boy for part of the time. We went from Swansea to Cardiff and back again. And it was one of the great chapels of the city, really. It had, in the 50s, a Sunday school of 500 children.
Oh, wow.
And a huge kind of outreach and presence in the community. So I felt very privileged, really, to be part of what was an extremely exciting and stimulating environment. And it was when we moved back to Swansea that we became members of the Anglican Church, partly because the Anglican Church there felt rather like the Presbyterian Church in Cardiff had felt. It was a church that took young people very seriously, that had a tremendous amount going on, and constantly gave you the impression that Christianity made you live in a bigger world rather than the smaller one.
That was your background. Growing up, did you then feel like you had a faith from early on? Was it something that there was a moment that you could put your finger on?
I can't remember a time when I wasn't involved in the life of the church and conscious of having a faith, I suppose. I guess that it was towards the end of my primary school days when I started going to the Junior Christian Endeavour group in chapel that it became a bit more personal. And then later on in my teens again, I often think of two events which really brought it home to me. One was, maybe surprising to say, when the curate in our parish took me along to a Russian Orthodox liturgy. And I was completely overwhelmed by an experience of beauty, worship, mystery, excitement in that. And that really deepened a great deal.
You hadn't experienced such a sort of high church sort of...
Well, we were quite a high church parish, but it wasn't so much high churchery. It was just that sense of awe in the presence of God, which the liturgy so conveys, the repeated Lord have mercy, the sense that you are on the edge of something enormous. And then a couple of years after that, when I went to, it was actually a local Congregationalist chapel in Swansea, to hear Richard Wurmbrand speaking about his experience as a prisoner in Romania. And again, suddenly, something came through to me of the seriousness of the claims of Christ, the seriousness of the gospel. Yeah. And I think of those two moments, especially in my teens, as having been decisive.
Right, and set you on the path to ministry. Was that something you knew was on the horizon?
It was something I'd been thinking about for a while. And in a sense, these experiences weren't so much about a call to ministry. They were about a call to take God seriously.
Yeah.
And those two things don't always go together. It's nice when they do.
It would lead as well in due course to an academic career as well, theology and so forth, as well as ordination. So take us through sort of those years, university and so forth.
Well, again, going back to my teenage years, my school days, I said earlier that the privilege I experienced of being part of Christian communities that really made you feel you were in a big world, and the parish priest in the church I was in as a teenager was somebody who really took that seriously, who gave me books to read, who encouraged me in every possible way to explore. And he was somebody who never said, oh, you mustn't ask that, or don't bother your pretty little head about it, so to speak. He would sit and take it very seriously and talk things through. And that was part of what made me feel, yes, I wanted to do theology as a student. And theology was just hugely exciting. It was a discovery of all sorts of dimensions in scripture, all sorts of dimensions in Christian history that I had only been dimly aware of. And the 3 years I spent studying theology at Cambridge excited me enormously. But I decided then to do research on something slightly unconventional. I think some of my teachers expected me to be doing research on, I don't know, the New Testament or the early church. And because I'd read a book in my third year as a student, a particular book, that's what I really want to explore. The book was, again, about the Eastern Christian Church. It's called The Mystical Theology of the Eastern Church by a Russian theologian, Vladimir Losky. And I decided, yes, I want to find out more about that, understand more about this familiar but strange Christian world. So I spent the 4 years after that burrowing away in Russian religious thought and, again, finding a big new world to inhabit.
Did the Orthodox Church ever attract you more than just on a study level?
Occasionally. But I couldn't quite cope with the idea that you had to sort of uproot yourself culturally. And although the Anglican Church is constantly exasperating. I just found that's the church. You know, that's
that was where your home
thought,
was.
I thought quite a bit about becoming a Roman Catholic at one point, partly because I was thinking a lot about being a monk in my early 20s. But again, I seemed to be brought back again and again to the fact, well, this is where God has put you, and don't go looking for a perfect church. Don't go looking for an ideal church, the one that you'd invent if you, you know, if you had the choice. Just inhabit the place where God has put you. Mm-hmm. And one thing that really brought it home to me was when I first started teaching in a theological college in my mid-20s. And all these very, very impressive people who were studying for the Anglican priesthood. And part of me just said, well, you know, if it's good enough for them, it's good enough for me. These are people who are so spiritually serious and committed. Why should I fuss? You know,
yeah.
Go with them.
A bit of an off-the-wall question, and we will come back to the story, but can you imagine if you hadn't gone for ministry in the Church of England, would there have been any other career path that would have made sense to you? I don't know. The box is wide open, I suppose, but could you have imagined yourself doing something else, and if so, what?
I suppose the only thing I much imagined myself doing after the age of 20 or so was being a university teacher. But part of what I was involved in as a student was quite a bit of what we now call community work. I used to go in the summer and help run adventure playground schemes in South London, and a bit of work with the homeless in Cambridge. And I did think at one point about social work as a future.
Being a social worker?
Right. But I think I sort of recognised that that would be saying no to quite a bit of what energised me, and going forward for ordination and theological study wasn't saying no to all the concerns about community and justice.
Exactly. I mean, and indeed, obviously in your time, that has been a big concern,
yes,
I think, of your...
Yeah. And I've often thought that, how should I put it, God gave me a kind of nudge on that. My second day, I think it was, in Cambridge as a student, meeting a homeless person on the street in Cambridge and getting into conversation and ending up spending a couple of hours with this man, as if God was saying, look, here you are in this very privileged place where you're going to have a great time studying. Just don't forget, will you, the shadow side of it all. Just don't forget the presence of these people.
Excellent. You met Jane while you were teaching in Cambridge. Was it love at first sight across a lecture theatre?
Oh, yes, I was meeting across a crowded seminar room. That's very romantic. Yes, we met at seminars quite regularly and went for tea afterwards. And
the rest is history.
The rest is history,
as they say.
And Jane was at that time working on her research in modern German theology. And I had some interests in that area, so we had plenty to talk about. Mm. And increasingly just discovered we had a lot of other things and enthusiasms in common.
And after academia, what followed on in terms of your continuing career in the church?
Well, I had the great good fortune all through, as it were, of having a bit of a balance of academic and pastoral work. So when I was first lecturing at Cambridge, I was also doing a curacy in the council estate in the town. When I became a professor in Oxford, the job was joined up with a canonry at Christ Church, the cathedral. So, you know, there was always that regular background of worshipping life. So I think I'd never imagined that I would spend my life just in the academic setting. There was always the church making a claim in various ways. So when, a bit out of the blue, this proposal came that I should go back to Wales as a bishop, my first thought was, well, yes, you know, that's very humbling and very surprising, but yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And how many years was it that you were a Bishop of Wales?
Nearly 11. Yeah. Bishop of Monmouth originally for 8 years, and then Archbishop of Wales for 3 years as well.
Right. And during that time, did you see a very different sort of side to the job you were doing, obviously from the more academic setting you had been in up to that point?
Yeah, somebody asked me not long after I'd moved back to Wales whether I was missing the teaching, and I said, well, actually, I'm still teaching. It's just in a different mode. and the challenge of how you make sense of things to a confirmation group in Abertillery. You know, that's as much of an intellectual challenge as a seminar group in Oxbridge. It was a very, very happy time. I think all the family would say that it was, for all the, you know, the struggles and the difficulties that being a bishop brings, it was a very happy time, and I was blessed with wonderful colleagues and a diocese that was small enough to know people quite well.
And young children as well,
of course, in the mix.
Of course,
yes. So, a lovely period.
Did it prepare you, in some ways, for what would follow?
In some ways, but of course nothing really prepares you for the level of public scrutiny and the level of, the attention given to your least and stupidest remarks. I think what it did prepare me for a little bit was, any bishop, well, any pastor really has to cope with being in the public eye a bit and being the place where a lot of people dump their problems and where a lot of the tensions meet. And although, as I say, it wasn't a dreadfully stressful decade or so, there were the difficulties, there were the challenges, and the challenges of making difficult decisions about the future of the church and sometimes the future of individual clergy. So a little bit of ground turned over, I think.
I'm Justin Brierley, and tonight I'm in conversation with Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. You can also read this interview in the April edition of Christianity Magazine. To claim a free copy, go to christianitymagazine.co.uk.
Let's talk about the last 10 years. When you entered your office as the Archbishop of Canterbury, what would you say were your hopes and dreams for the Anglican Church in the period that you knew you were going to be an incumbent?
Well, when I was asked what the priorities were at the beginning, I said two things were really at the top of my list. One was doing something about general theological literacy, you know, promoting the idea of a church that took thinking seriously. Partly because I experienced in my own life, in Jane's life, the life of so many others, the sense of theology as something enriching, not threatening or undermining. And the second thing was really to do with one of the most stretching and exciting things that had happened to me in Wales, which was encountering the first green shoots of what we now call the Fresh Expressions thing, just discovering new congregations springing up and learning a lot from the experience of people who were pushing the boat out in terms of new styles of Christian life. And so when I went to Canterbury, one of the first things I thought was, now how are we going to get this as a real coordinated priority for the church? And so within 18 months, 2 years, we were launching the Fresh Expressions movement in the Church of England, because it came right at the moment when Bishop Graham Cray was publishing his report on mission-shaped church. And it just seemed to be the moment when God was dropping a heavy hint that this was what we should be.
Several years on, has that been what you wanted it to be?
I think my hopes and prayers and lots of other people's hopes and prayers have been very richly met there. In terms simply of numbers, they don't always show up on the statistics, unfortunately, but we know from figures we've collected that, you know, probably the equivalent of the numbers of a whole worshipping diocese have been added. These are not people who are counted in the conventional Sunday worshipper register.
Because that's the whole point. It's not conventional worship in that
just
sense.
Just within that.
Yeah.
But I think more than anything, it's given permission to a lot of very adventurous, creative, entrepreneurial people to go and do new things. And I've really enjoyed the time I've spent with some of the leaders of these groups. I've fairly regularly met them and in large and small groups and talk to them and listen to what they're up to. And whenever I used to go and do a diocesan visit as Archbishop, I'd ask to be put in touch with people doing Fresh Expressions type things locally. And right the way through, it's been a terrific gift, a real lifter of the spirits. So it's contributed in that sense that whatever the media may say about the church, actually, the real church as opposed to the virtual church, as I sometimes put it, is not doing too badly out there. And so Fresh Expressions, because we had wonderful leadership in Steve Croft and then Graham Cray, and all those who were involved, wonderful collaboration from the other churches who invested so generously in it, Methodist Church first and then other groups. So, you know, yes, yeah. It's...
Well, on the other end of the scale, what would you say has been the greatest challenge during your time?
No surprises there, really. Just the different ends of the communion drifting further apart, and the extreme difficulty of getting people around the table to keep them talking. Yeah.
Specifically, obviously, on homosexuality and women.
Well, often the women bishops' issue is not an issue in the communion, and often misunderstood in those terms. Of course, it's an issue for the Church of England, and we're not out of the wood yet there. But I'd always seen it as the role of an archbishop, just to try to keep people at the table.
Yes.
And the difficulty is that a lot of people think the role of an archbishop is to solve it. You know, pronouncements. That's enough from you lot.
Yeah.
We're going this way. That's enough from you lot. We're going that way. And
do you feel like you did keep people at the table?
Limited success, I'd say. Limited success. It was a pain, obviously, that a lot of people decided. And I don't mean a pain. I mean painful.
Yes.
That a lot of people decided they couldn't come to the Lambeth Conference. Even so, you know, a lot did come. And we discovered a new way of doing business there, which just helped, especially people from some of the smaller churches whose voices are often muffled here. It helped them feel they had a role. One of the most moving things I heard about the Lambeth Conference was a bishop from Melanesia, the Pacific, saying what a lot of us felt coming from the outlying provinces, the ones that don't make the headlines, was that we weren't just being steamrolled by loud voices from America or even Africa. We actually have room to talk for ourselves. And I suppose in my time I tried to give a little bit of priority in visits and so forth to some of those churches which were a bit, you know, off the centre, and to minority churches under pressure. So the visits I remember that really kind of made an impact to me were to Melanesia, to the Solomon Islands, to Sudan, where we're not talking about a small church, but about a church that's under horrendous pressure.
Absolutely.
A very moving visit to Pakistan, which created some long-lasting friendships and contacts. More recently, Congo, heartbreaking place to be. Tiny Anglican church doing disproportionately large things. Mm. Burundi. You know, those are the places that really, really stick.
Turning to matters quite recent, the defeat of the vote on women bishops. Mm. How did you feel when the result was announced?
I felt, of course, a deep sense of sadness, feeling that we were in danger of almost losing a generation of very able women clergy who would probably now not
go
make
forward
it in time. And just feeling that somehow we had, all of us, and I do mean all of us, you know, bishops myself included, somehow just not managed it well, and it wasn't communicating the gospel somehow the way we'd done our business. And I don't know what we could have done differently. I don't know for certain. I've got ideas. But it was that feeling that we were certainly hung out to dry in the eyes of the world, you know.
What I was surprised by was the reaction of people who, in all honesty, probably don't have a lot to do with the Church of England, but nonetheless felt very strongly about it.
It's fascinating that in spite of what people say about the secularisation of the country, so many people, surprising people, still have, as I've put it, an investment in the church. They still want the church to look serious, and they're worried that it doesn't. Now, quite clearly, the church can't govern itself by opinion polls or by the reaction of unbelievers. That's not a particularly good programme. At the same time, you have to ask, and I think this is a good New Testament principle, what does it look like? What does it sound like? There's more than once in Paul's epistles and in Peter as well, you have that, you know, just bear in mind, are you making sense to the people around you? Are you speaking their language? Are you answering the real questions? And that's always worth asking.
When it comes to you being the spokesperson representative for the Church of England, I think many people were thrilled to have an academic who could, you know, represent the theology.
They live to regret.
Well, the question, but then you, there have been those who have said, well, perhaps you were too academic. Some have perhaps suggested, you know, too intellectual to be understood by ordinary people. What do you say to those who have sort of wondered at that sort of
thing? Well, the first thing is, you know, I've got to please everybody. But I think that there just are conflicting expectations here. On the one hand, I think people hoped that an archbishop with an academic background would help to make sense to the intellectual world, which is asking some very tough and very complex questions, which you can't just write off with simple answers. On the other hand, of course, any pastor has to speak direct to the needs of people who aren't necessarily intellectuals, and on people's deathbeds or in bereavement and poverty and pressure, they don't want theories.
Mm.
And the problem I never really resolved in speaking in public was when you're speaking to a large number of people, you really can't do either one or the other very well. I found some of the greatest satisfaction in, you know, doing assemblies in schools and in parish visits. And I made it a big priority to keep up the school visits and to visit a parish in Canterbury Diocese once a fortnight when I could, and other parishes elsewhere in the country, and do these pastoral visits to dioceses, which involved a lot of, you know, grassroots contact. Yeah. And I think I'd have gone mad without all that.
Yes, because I suppose it's that pressure of the media sort of requires us to speak in sound bites these days, and it's very difficult to often put ideas across in a sound bite.
It can be sometimes, yes. And also, what you might want to say to somebody pastorally isn't always something that translates, and oughtn't to be something that translates into media terms. And again, it's a point I've touched on before, but I think it's true. I think it's true, and I think it's quite important. Most people who ask about, say, the problem of suffering, are not asking for a theory. They're asking for a hand on the shoulder, or a word that allows them to get up tomorrow morning. And you can't put that over in soundbite form. You just can't. And that's why the face-to-face contact for me is always the heart of it.
Have there been moments that particularly spring to mind when you were frustrated by the way the media reported something you said? I'm sure you could think of plenty, I mean, what was the big one for you?
I wouldn't single out any, but I think it's like the weather, as I've put it once or twice. You can't get away from it. It changes. It's there. You sort of live with it and try and look for the least stupid way of responding, not always successfully. It's no good whinging. That's how it is. Absolutely. We are in a particular kind of media culture, and the 24-hour news cycle is a very, very voracious eater. It just wants food all the time, and it wants conflict and drama all the time.
Indeed.
And, that it's not always what's actually happening.
Another issue that came up a year or two back now, you edited The New Statesman.
Oh, yes.
There was some controversy over that, where people suggested you were politicising your role and so forth. Any response to that? Did you sort of agree with that, or obviously?
I didn't feel particularly repentant about that. I felt it was interesting that The Statesman had asked me to do that. And I've always said it's not the business of an archbishop or a bishop or a pastor to tie the church's agenda to that of any particular party, any particular programme or manifesto. But it is the responsibility to raise certain ethical questions.
And you were raising the questions around whether the big society was really a cover for
is it really to the most
disadvantaged?
Yeah. And I think it's a good question. It's not just mine, it's a question lots of people are asking, and are still asking. It seems to me that in the last few years we've almost dropped the ball in terms of responding to the massive financial crisis of 08-09. And so many people were saying, well, we've got to rethink our economic assumptions, our banking practices and so forth. We've got to rethink that quite fundamentally. And I may have missed this, but I haven't seen very much evidence yet. That being said, what's interesting there is the number of people who, more or less in private, will say, of course we can't go on like this. And I mean people in quite high positions in those worlds. I think we are still on the edge of something really both disturbing and full of opportunity there. And we haven't heard the last of it.
Another thing that's been in the news was a few of these cases of discrimination, supposed discrimination against Christians. Where do you see all of that business? Do you sort of see that there is some discrimination going on, Christians in workplaces and so forth, or is it over-exaggerated?
I think there are a number of separate strands in all this. One is about the freedom to manifest your religious faith, which is, you know, quite a delicate legal question. You can hold your faith, can you also manifest it? And I think the feeling is that human rights legislation allows you to manifest your faith, that is to talk about it, to show it by wearing a cross, so forth. I'm very glad that the ruling was
in favour in that case.
Because I think that was a bit of petty silliness, really. And then there's this very difficult question of what your responsibilities are if you sign up for a job which may require you to do things that are in conflict with your conscience. And I think the European Court was feeling its way, and it's interesting that there was a strong minority judgment on opinion on this as well as the official judgment. I think a lot of lawyers are really rather at sea about this. What's the trump card in legislation? Is it religious liberty? Liberty of conscience? Is it the right of access, so to speak, to services on the part of the public? And what I see is not so much a kind of sustained campaign to be nasty to Christians as an awful lot of muddle about this. We've intensified the regime about rights of access, human rights in general, perhaps at the expense of underlining freedom of conscience at times. We now have a real kind of legal, not standoff, but a tension there, which is going to have to be resolved in due course by case law. But as I say, I don't see this as a deliberate campaign. It's much more we're in a climate where people don't quite understand how religious conviction works very well, and unsurprisingly get themselves in a great tangle about how to honour it legally without undermining some of them, you know, the public universal provisions allowed. So,
I mean,
I'm not rushing to the barricades on this one.
Some people talk about, you know, the increased secularisation of the country and so forth. I mean, you debated Richard Dawkins, I think, about a year ago in Oxford, and does Christendom have anything to fear from a sort of secularisation, atheism and so forth?
Christianity, I think, has, first of all, has nothing to fear. I do take that absolutely seriously. That's a fundamental biblical principle, that one of the first things that Jesus says to the apostles is, don't be afraid. So let's not cast it in terms of what Christianity has to fear. We have the promises of God. You know, basic as that. Have we reason to be grumpy and anxious? Put it that way. Well, sometimes yes. And what's the future? Can we be confident that the church will be respected, influential, taken seriously? Well, no, actually. There's no guarantee of that in the Bible or anywhere else. So don't let's imagine that the welfare, the well-being, the advance of the kingdom of God is bound up with our being popular and influential. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It comes and goes, historically. And just get used to that. As for explicit attacks on the Christian faith by some intellectuals, well, what strikes me is that there are no new arguments I'm hearing here. Last summer I picked up a book in a second-hand bookshop in Edinburgh, which was a Christian response to attacks on the faith from anthropologists, physicists, biologists and others, written in 1932. And I read through it and thought, This is, you know,
exactly.
Plus
exactly
change, yes,
what we've been hearing. And there really aren't any new arguments here, and some of the confusions are exactly what they were then. So I don't lose too much sleep over that.
No. I run a show which very often brings atheists and Christians into dialogue. Do you feel people are more sceptical now than when you began about Christianity, about faith, or do you sense an openness that actually that continues to exist, even though the polls tell us, you know, less people are signing the Christian box in the census and so forth?
I don't feel that more people are hostile to faith than they were 40 years ago, say. In fact, there have been times when I've felt people are less hostile. But we're also living in a culture where commitment is not fashionable or easy, where people don't sign up for the long term. And that's not just about churches, it's about political parties, it's about your readership of a daily paper, it's about relationships too sometimes. Commitment is not easy, not stylish. And I think it's inevitable that religious commitment should be affected by that as well.
Yeah.
So I think rather than simply thinking we are having a bad time, we ought to be asking exactly what is it about the culture we're in that is so short-term, so commitment-phobic, so reluctant to join, to be part of a community.
One of the things that seems to be a concern is whether children are really engaged with Christianity at school. There seems to be wide levels of biblical illiteracy at the moment.
How would you like to see RE teaching improved, and especially what to do about this biblical illiteracy?
Well, let's take two ways into that. One, I think, is to try and make sure that when you're teaching about Christian faith or other faiths, you have actual practitioners talking to you at some point. It doesn't mean every RE teacher has to be a paid-up member of whatever, but make sure that you build into the teaching the presence of someone who is really committed, so that children get some sense of what it feels like, what it looks like to belong to this. You're not just doing it from outside. This is not an anthropological study of remote eccentrics. This is about actual people you can talk to and ask questions of. One thing. Second thing with the biblical issue, I think probably we need to think a lot more in religious education of what I think of as the ways in sideways to biblical stories. The Bible Society has done some very interesting work in the last few years, commissioning television dramas based on biblical sources. And of course, the Bush Theatre put on that series of 66 books, short plays, relating to every book of the Bible a couple of years ago. Now, how do you use those effectively to reconnect people with, well, not reconnect, connect for the first time with texts and stories that they don't really know? It's a very exciting thing, actually. And when I've been in schools and sometimes I've been asked about biblical stories or what's your favourite bit of the Bible or something, it's really fascinating to see what happens when you tell people stories or introduce them to passages for the first time and say, you may not know it, but the Bible says this. Mm. Or this is what the parable of the Good Samaritan is really about. And
It's all those new ways of retelling the story, introducing it in fresh ways.
That's right.
What can the church do in that sense to support people, especially, you know, looking back at the things you've commented on, the crisis in finance and so forth, the values that seem to be lacking sometimes in certain areas. What can churches do to equip Christians to bring those values into their workplaces, into, you know, truth, forgiveness and so forth?
Well, I think the beginning is a very simple thing, which is to ask how many parishes or congregations actually give people in work the opportunity to think out loud with others in groups of five or six about where some of these things have happened. Because maybe if you said, okay, well, during Lent or during Advent or whatever, we're going to encourage people week by week just to share one by one whether there are any moments in specifically in their work engagement where they felt a question of value has come up, and get some discernment together about how that's worked. Now, very often people feel the priority for study groups is back to biblical literacy, you know, let's get people familiar with the outlines of the faith.
But I think the two go together, really. And there ought to be a little bit of doing and froing there.
You've spoken of often during your time as about the imperative call of discipleship. Mm. Now, if churches are going to take that seriously, the discipleship, what should clergy or ministers spend most of their time doing? And how does that work out in practice?
Mm. I don't think clergy have to spend all their time running groups. I think they have to make sure that they happen. And sometimes they need the courage or the generosity of spirit to let them happen and not kind of dig them up to see if they're growing. But it's been said that a big aspect of the life of clergy these days, bigger than it used to be, is coordinating. You're holding together lots of smaller groups. Yeah. I think that's an important part of the training.
Enabling people on the ground to do
a bit
it
more for themselves.
For themselves.
And also being able to, what's the word, animate and hold together the big events where people come together for common celebration, to find a common language and perspective.
I think the problems any church minister faces is that they're in the Christian bubble, and they're not at the workplace. And so very often you don't have the connection to know exactly what people are facing. And so it's a question of how you sort of...
You need to do some listening. There.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm Justin Brierley, and tonight I'm in conversation with Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. You can also read this interview in the April edition of Christianity Magazine. To claim a free copy, go to christianitymagazine.co.uk.
A personal question now. In your time as Archbishop of Canterbury, have you ever had doubts about God?
Doubts about God, doubts that God exists, doubts that God is loving. I don't think so. Doubts about whether I'm making any sense of God. Yes, very regularly. And a bit of a sense of sometimes banging my head against a brick wall in prayer and saying, I just do not know what is going on. Mm. A lot of that. But that's, I think, why it matters so much to me to say, the promises of God are where we start and finish, not how it feels, how it looks for me or for society at any one moment. The gates of hell shall not prevail, that sort of stuff.
When you have hit those very stressful times, those banging your head against a brick wall times, where have you drawn your spiritual strength from, your mental strength from?
I suppose it's a mixture of things. One is the sheer fact of feeling committed to doing it every day, just get up and pray, get up and sit there, kneel there, and say, here I am.
The discipline.
Yes. Mm. Unfashionable, but yes. As a priest, I'm obliged to say morning and evening prayer every day. I'm obliged by personal resolve to spend a certain amount of time every day in silent prayer. And you just do it. No argument. Discipline rhythm does uphold you, and I think it's a great blessing that we have got the daily offices of morning and evening prayer.
Because you can't always come up with the words yourself, necessarily.
No, it's a matter of like swinging from ring to ring in the gym. You put yourself forward and grab hold of the next one and keep moving. Mm. Not that I'm a great aficionado of gyms, but they tell me. The other things that keep me going, I suppose, are the example of other people's faith. Okay, I'm not making much of this, but look at him, look at her.
Any individuals you could specifically mention in that respect?
Lots of obvious heroes of the last few decades, the Desmond Tutus of this world and so on. But I'm thinking more of the people I meet, again, pastorally and face-to-face, the people I meet running a project for trafficked women, people I meet running a project for children on the streets in South London, the people I meet in hospices, and sometimes listening to and praying with somebody in a hospice. I'm thinking back to a youngish mother I was with a couple of years ago in a hospice, who did in fact die not long afterwards, and just listening to her expression of faith and her expression of concern for her children. It's those things that come back when you say, it makes sense for them. It's a bit like what I was saying about teaching in a theological college. If it's good enough for them, it ought to be good enough for me. Somewhere it's making sense. Somewhere the connection's being made. I may not feel at this particular moment that the connection's being made here in me. I'm just kind of paddling along, hopefully. But somewhere it's making sense. And if it makes sense in circumstances like that, it makes sense, period.
Yes.
And then the third thing is just the unexpected ways in which in worship, in some great celebration, or indeed in some not-so-great celebration, some quiet event in a parish church in East Kent or somewhere, you feel something's happening. I don't know what it is. I don't know what I've got to do with it, but something's happening.
The presence of God in some way.
Yeah. A God who acts. A God who, to put it very crudely, has promised to turn up.
What about when you're just relaxing? What's the way you just sort of turn off or, you know, do something else? Are there any hobbies or guilty pleasures, you know, that you sort of indulge in when you can?
I suppose I've always been a compulsive reader, and reading is what I always turn to for relaxation. But
hefty theological things, I don't know, Harry Potter or something.
I like novels. Really like novels. Sometimes, the great classics, the George Eliots and the Dickenses. Sometimes more modern things. Great enthusiasm for A.S. Byatt, for instance. And sometimes, when I'm really tired, just a detective story.
Good.
And also theatre. I'm fond of theatre. Unfortunately, so is the rest of the family. So,
What have you seen recently?
We went just after Christmas to see Simon Callow's Christmas Carol. And last autumn we went to the RSC's Julius Caesar, the one with an all-black cast. Fantastic production.
Your passion is theology. Are there any strands of theology that worry you in the church? I'm thinking there are so many out there, but the prosperity gospel that some churches preach, a very conservative sort of end of the spectrum type of theology, perhaps a very liberal end of the spectrum theology. I mean, are there any particular strands that sort of give you cause for concern?
Yes, there are some. I guess that sometime in my 20s, I thought, and it's partly to do with contacts with Eastern Orthodox Church again, there is a great central classical creedal tradition expressed in the Nicene Creed and the worship of the church in general, and the shape of the Eucharist, which tells me that the universe is made completely freely by a God whose life is intrinsically relationship, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. And we know that because one of those eternal moments in the divine life, the eternal Son becomes human, enables us by the gift of the Holy Spirit to pray with him and in him to the Father, and we express that when we symbolically share his body and blood in Holy Communion. And I think when I reflect on all that, that's it. That's what we need to know. That's what we need to know. And it's the theologies that kind of veer off on one end or the other that worry me. The ones that say, well, actually, does it really matter that much if we talk about God as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or are these just ways of talking? Does it matter that Jesus is unique, that he's the only human being in whom the eternal Word of God has been fully, unequivocally present? Does it matter whether we say this or that about the Eucharist or baptism? I think, well, it actually does, rather. This is the whole shape of life and prayer and hope that's being defined here. So I do get worried by some kinds of liberal theology, by the ones that
deny the uniqueness of Christ,
that seem to suggest, well, pretty well anything goes.
That try to paint everything as metaphor rather than...
Yeah. I think there's tough, truthful reality here that we've got to have our noses rubbed in.
I mean, on the other end...
And the other end is people saying, Well, in addition to all that, I'm going to tell you, 16 extra things you've got to believe in order to qualify as a real Christian, including sometimes what seems to me a very wooden and also a very modern approach to every single proposition in the Bible being true in the sense that a statement in this morning's Times might be held to be true. And
so sort of creationism and that sort of that kind of area of things, yeah.
Yes, indeed. And I feel, well, that's, you know, that's piling on a set of hoops to jump through. I'm mixing my metaphors. and piling on things that aren't really part of that great central set of affirmations in the New Testament. Even where, let's say, the way in which salvation operates is concerned, I think, to take what I know is quite a controversial subject, the language of penal substitution, the atonement Christ bears our punishment for us, is part of a spectrum in the New Testament, and a very important part, and I'm not wanting to deny it. But is that the only way that redemption is spoken of in the New Testament? Of course it isn't. There's a whole range of other things. And right through the history of the church, there have been this variety of ways of talking about it. And for me, that simply says what's going on in the cross and the resurrection is so colossal that there's no one theory that's going to
get
all of it in. And
you wouldn't give penal substitutionary atonement precedence over any other way of looking at
it. And I think it's, again, a rather curiously modern way of coming at it. That, as I say, that in some sense, Christ is carrying the consequence of my sin and yours and everyone else's. Yes. And that.
I mean, the way I often, I sometimes wonder whether we sort of lose sight in that whole debate of the fact that at the end of the day, we believe it's God up there on the cross, you know, taking whatever this punishment might be. It's not as though, it's not this image of a...
It's not somebody trading with the Father for favourable conditions.
Sort of,
goodness knows it's a complicated thing. And I remember when I was talking to my own daughter before her confirmation about this, this was the most difficult thing we got into.
Right. Well, I got grilled by it. I don't know if you've heard of Mark Driscoll. He's quite a well-known preacher in the US, and I did an interview about a year ago with him, and he got a bit upset by some of the questions I was asking him. So he turned the tables on me at the end and started grilling me on my theology, and for him, this was a key issue.
You wait till I start.
Do you believe in penal substitutionary atonement? And I took the same line as you. Well, I think I don't deny it. I think there's a range of, in the range of explanation, ways of looking at
but
the cross.
Is it the condition for putting our trust in Christ as Saviour? I don't think the New Testament says that.
I think you've said yourself that the job of Archbishop of Canterbury really needs two people to do it almost. So do you have any sort of thoughts on that? Should the role be changed in some way? Does the Church of England in general need to sort of become a bit more streamlined in the way it can respond to things? That sort of thing. It's quite a big area.
It's a big area. I haven't got any instant wisdom on that, I'm afraid. I do feel the danger is you're always reacting and therefore always trying to grapple with stuff being thrown at you. And I think it's quite important just to say, well, on some things I actively want to do X, Y, and Z. And we must make room for that. So it's a small thing, not entirely trivial, but not unimportant, I think. Especially in the last few years, saying to my diary secretaries and people who manage the programme, look, I really do want to be visiting a certain number of schools and a certain number of projects. I would like to take the opportunity of offering a Q&A with sixth formers or a day conference for school children on this or that subject. And quite early on as Archbishop, we decided we would have a series of youth days at Lambeth that once a year we'd have about 100 teenagers and young adults into Lambeth for the day and construct a programme for them. That kind of thing. Just make sure those are there. So
that you have some say over what your diary looks like in a given year.
And the way things go, you're bound to be reacting to a lot. But if you have a sense as I think I did, that you really want to keep this engagement going for your own sake as much as anyone else's, then start early and get that booked in.
Yeah.
Whether the expectations of the Archbishop are unrealistic, I don't know. The role changes with every incumbent and will go on changing.
If you had one piece of advice for your successor, what would it be?
It's funny, I've been asked that more than once. I think I would underline the absolute importance of keeping in touch with the front line, with the parishes, with the schools. And, you know, find what nourishes you and make room for it.
Another question you've probably been asked lots of times. What strengths do you think Justin Welby will bring to the position?
Loads. I'm really so excited by his appointment. Genuinely, the work that he did for me and for the other primates of the communion a couple of years ago in one of our conferences of primates was a wonderful example of mediation and getting people together, holding people at the table once again. He's got all of that experience from his time in Coventry, the Cross of Nails community. He's got the international experience that he brings to bear from time in Nigeria and elsewhere. And, of course, all that enormous expertise and sophistication in the financial field, as well as, I think, a real direct, lucid theological conviction, which comes through so often in what he says. He's a focused, clear, and very impressive thinker. So,
and very spiritual as well.
Very deeply, yes. Yes, who's known deep trial and challenge in his own life. And yes, just thank God.
The thumbs up all round.
Absolutely.
That's all the questions, you'll be glad to know. Thank you very much for being with me today, Rowan. It's been lovely to chat to you.
I hope you enjoyed today's interview from the archives with Rowan Williams, and I'm sure we'll have Rowan on again in the not-too-distant future on Unbelievable. He's a fascinating theological mind. Don't forget that tonight, if you haven't already booked in and it's not too late to do so, you can join our live conversation with Tim Keller. It's Unbelievable Live. Unbelievable.live is the place to go to register for that if you'd like to be part of our online audience and ask your own questions as well. If you want more from the show, including our newsletter, YouTube channel, ways to give, and all of our past shows and many other articles and resources, go to our website, premierunbelievable.com. For now, thanks for being with us and see you next time.